Well, in his first official act as our minister for youth and young adult initiatives, Ian McPherson invited a group of people to attend the new Mr. Rogers film. I wasn't able to attend the film last week, the new documentary about Fred Rogers and his work, but I did see the film later in the week. The heyday of Mr. Rogers was a little before my time. I knew the basic outline of his story as a Presbyterian minister diverted from the pulpit to public television. But not until really seeing this film could I appreciate how deeply rooted was his work in the gospel itself. That phrase that he made famous, after all, is strictly biblical. "Won't you be my neighbor?" is an invitation to love inspired by the greatest commandment of Jesus, that we would love our neighbors as ourselves. And the idea of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood showed people across the lines of difference relating to each other. Mr. Rogers used the television show to chip away at the narrative of tribalism. The subtle suggestions that we receive often through television, but not only through television, that you know, these people are my people and those people are a threat to me. I learned in this film that the very first episode, way back in 1968, introduced a character named King Friday the 13th, who was determined to protect his castle by building a wall. One of the most famous scenes shows Mr. Rogers bathing his feet in a swimming pool with an African-American police officer, modeling an alternative to children who had only seen images of black people and white people not sharing pools together. In fact, at this time, African-Americans were being driven away from public pools. But Mr. Rogers wasn't always just preaching the gospel of neighborliness. He was also converted by the gospel of neighborliness. I learned in this film that he once told an actor that he could never come back to the show if it was publicly revealed that he was a gay person. But some years later, he sang to that same actor on his television show a song, "I Love You Just the Way You Are." Well, let's shift from Mr. Rogers to King David, who was a rising star in ancient Israel. The death of King Saul in battle with the Philistines, however, did not yield a smooth transition of power. As you might imagine, the late king had his own loyalists who were reasonably suspicious of David, given his many earlier efforts to sabotage his king and rival. Besides, others in Saul's court had their own designs on taking the throne. So as the book of 2 Samuel opens, the monarchy is split. David has consolidated power only over the tribe of Judah. He establishes himself in a shadow capital called Hebron, and a soldier named Joab emerges as his most trusted deputy. David and Joab will rule Israel together for much of the duration of the narrative. But the other tribes of Israel, they have their own king. Their own king with a rather unfortunate Hebrew name, Ish-bosheth, which means shame. He was merely a puppet to the real power behind the throne, Abner. So the nation that was united to dispel a shared enemy, the Philistines, turns its hostilities inward and against itself, commencing a civil war. David and the tribe of Judah versus the other tribes of Israel. In chapter 2, Abner and Joab, the two deputies, meet on the field of battle. It's an anticlimactic scene that features no fighting, but some strong language. "You surely know that it will be bitterness in the end," Abner says. Before too long, the civil conflict is ultimately resolved. Recognizing David's continuous growth and strength in number, Abner reluctantly seeks conciliation with the tribe of Judah. And in this series of diplomatic overtures, Joab dupes him into a private conversation and then stabs him in the belly. David insists that he had nothing to do with Abner's death, of course. His hands need to be clean of Abner's blood in order to cultivate the trust of Abner's people. Repeatedly, he points the finger of responsibility back to Joab. But it's one of those cases where he's so repetitious in his lament over the death of Abner that his denial seems a little suspicious. The author of the biblical narrative seems to be hinting that David actually ordered Abner's assassination. It all works out to David's advantage anyway, because without Abner's protection, Ishbosheth, the shameful king, flees for his life. And these events bring us to the occasion of today's reading, the end of Israel's civil war and David's anointing as the leader of a united monarchy. Well, Israel is born of 12 tribes that eventually unite, but not because they have a vision of a shared future. No, they come together because togetherness assures their survival. They're the kind of people who are united more by what they are against than by what they are for. The 12 tribes don't really like each other. But they sure hate the Ammonites, and they sure don't like the Amalekites, and they can sure fight together against the Philistines. It's a nation born under the constant assumption that it is under attack. In the absence of outsiders to fight, they'll start to attack each other. This is why it's so dangerous to define yourself only negatively, by what you don't like, or by what you don't stand for. What do you stand for? What will bring us together? This is what tribalism is. It's the proclivity to define yourself over and against everything that you are not. And among its many attending dangers is the myth that everyone is out to get me. The distinctions are sharp and defensive. It's us versus them. These are our friends, and those are our enemies. Maybe you have heard it being said. They are taking our jobs. They are selling drugs to our children. Tribalism feeds on this sort of siege mentality, the notion that we're constantly under assault, or that we have to take extreme measures to protect ourselves. And as we make so much ado about the nefarious intentions of strangers and aliens, we grant ourselves permission to treat them inhumanely. We begin to think of them as disposable. Perhaps we even speak of them as animals. We start to justify incrementally and progressively insensitivity, and then unkindness, and then cruelty. People who would never, under any ordinary circumstances, accept the unrestrained authority of a monarch revel in the excesses of the king because David gets results. He fought off the Philistines. He defends us. Do you remember what the people Israel said so long ago when Samuel tried to warn them that they would not want a king? I've only preached about this 4 or 5 times this summer. You know, "He will take your harvest," Samuel said. "He'll send your young men off to war," Samuel said. "He'll take your women as his concubines," Samuel said. And do you remember what the people said? "No. There will be a king," they said way back in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel. There will be a king over us, and our king will go out before us. And this is the critical part. Our king will fight our battles for us. See, the king is a projection of the tribe. Tribalism may be our instinct. We may be tempted to resort to tribalistic impulses. These are my people, we are prone to say. But the gospel offers us an alternative vision of life. The gospel announces there is a better way to live. Jesus Christ says, look, the tribe of Benjamin is not your tribe. The people who live in Hebron is not your tribe. Your nation, Israel, is not even your tribe. Jesus Christ says that our tribe is nothing but all of creation. Jesus has made every stranger, alien, and other a member of our tribe. There is no us versus them because there is only us. For every human being has been made in the image of God, and we can see the face of Christ in every human face. The Apostle Paul says that we are all members of the same body, and when one member suffers, all suffer with it. But the other thing is that the love of Jesus actually helps us to accept the insecurity that we live with. I don't know if this is actually true, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have heard that there is a church in Chapel Hill. I won't say which church it is because I haven't called over there and asked them if it's true. But I have heard that there is a church in Chapel Hill that has a policy of keeping its doors unlocked day and night so that anyone, anytime, can come in to pray. Which, of course, raises the question of security. What about the people who might steal our things or mess our stuff up? But I'm told that this church takes it as an article of faith that the gospel compels us to accept our insecurity. I don't know if it's true, but I sure hope it's true. I hope there is a church in our community that holds out that radical witness. Because what a beautiful idea that the faith of Jesus makes everything possible. Makes it possible in a very literal sense to keep our doors wide open. There is a hymn called Blessed Assurance. See, our faith is the assurance that God will be present to us when we are insecure. And what does it mean, after all, that God takes on human flesh, except that God blesses us in our insecurity and our vulnerability? David discovers here, well, he doesn't discover it here, maybe he'll eventually get it, that tribalism is a false promise. He fights outsiders all that he can until suddenly there's no one left to fight except his own family. Until there's no one left to fight except himself. In conditions of scarcity and insecurity, the tribe always seems to get smaller and smaller and smaller as the conflict turns inward. The nation battles outsiders. The states battle the nation. The tribes battle the states. The village battles the tribe. The family battles the village. The son battles the father. The David story will show us that even the family is corrupted by the tribal impulse. Absalom will turn on his father and compete with him for the throne. In our self-interest, as we turn to the tribe for our security, we discover that the tribe is always more and more divisible. But we cannot divide our way to salvation. That's why the grace of God is always expansive and inclusive. It reaches further and further and further, Paul says, without partiality. That's why Jesus comes into the world, not just for one group or for another group, but for all of creation. Christ will reign, Luke says, in Judea and in Samaria and to the ends of the earth. Come from the north and from the south and from the east and from the west, because all people from the four corners of the globe are welcome at this table. Love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. We are not saved by defending the tribe, but by expanding it. So if there is in our hearts even a hint of an us versus them mentality, our only hope is more connection. Who are they? Who are those people? Aren't they human? Can't we relate to them? We have no need to be afraid. Our faith is all the assurance we need to reach out and open our hearts and open our doors. I often think of Sarah and Abraham, these desert nomads who are called out into the desert. They're called to travel over this barren land with no resources, and they are credited with offering the first practices of hospitality. In the evenings when they would make camp, they would watch the horizon, and as they saw a party approaching in the great distance, they would actually come out of their tent and walk toward them. This was partially to determine if they had any intentions to hurt their camp. But the desert was such a dangerous environment, and separate parties depended on each other for kindness. So Sarah and Abraham, though they had little water and little bread themselves, and though they lived in such extreme conditions, they always offered some water, some bread. You see, way back in the beginning, even among people who were living at the very threshold of survival, there is an impulse in our hearts to hold up a better way to live. Mr. Rogers preached a very, very old gospel. Won't you be my neighbor? Amen.